is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Tie game under the fourth quarter. Why do they just dribble the clock out and take a contested pull-up? Well, taking losing in regulation off the table is a massive improvement in your win probability.
Author and basketball researcher Seth Partnow covers the NBA and basketball analytics for The Athletic. He's the former director of basketball research for the Milwaukee Bucks. His book, The Mid-Range Theory, dives into topics from shot selection to evaluating prospects to considering aesthetics and ethics while analyzing box scores. Before joining the Bucks, Seth was the lead writer and managing editor of the Nylon Calculus, a basketball analytics website. Seth previously worked as an educational consultant focusing on the issues of cross-cultural communication and learning styles in Alaska. Though a very different context, this experience honed the skills needed to successfully navigate the often difficult divide between data science and statistics on one hand and sports-specific expertise on the other. Seth is originally from Anchorage, Alaska, and has a BA in economics from Carleton College, where he played basketball, and a JD from University of Minnesota. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Jason Franzen from Third Side Basketball Academy, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. During the 2022 NBA Finals, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 22% off all software packages. Just use the code CHAMPION22 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at HoopheadsPod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Coach, do you have a point guard or leader you're going to be counting on next season to run the show for you? Don't leave their success and your team's success to chance, or you may end up disappointed. Thousands of coaches send their players to a point guard college camp each year so they can discover how to think the game, lead your team, and run the show. They'll send them back to you a smarter player, a better leader, and better equipped to foster a championship culture next season in practice and in the locker room. You can go to pgcbasketball.com to find a camp near you. Take some notes and get some great insights as you listen to this episode with Seth Partnow, author of The Mid-Range Theory and former director of basketball research for the Milwaukee Bucks. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. But I am pleased to be joined by Seth Partnow from The Athletic, former director of research and analytics with the Milwaukee Bucks and author of the book, The Mid-Range Theory. Seth, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Should I be insulted that he hasn't joined us today?
You should not. So okay. Jason, so here's why you should not be insulted. Jason has 4 kids and he just brought home his fourth child, which is his daughter who was born 5 weeks ago. And so he was on our first episode, but when the episode ended, he was holding his daughter in the basement of his house with his dog running circles around him. So he decided that it might not have been the best option for him to continue. So that's why Jason is not with us. So
well now I feel like a jerk. So
no need. He's we joked on the first one that he's been understandably absent from our interviews over the last month or two. So he's got to kind of work his way back in to the swing of things. So first of all, welcome. Glad to have you.
Thank you.
All right, let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball when you were younger and sort of where you developed your interest in it.
You know, that's a long time ago. But I think when I was about, and if either of my parents listened to this, and why would they? They can correct me. they can correct me. I think when I was about, I want to say 8, I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, and we lived in a house in one part of town. And then when I was about 8, we moved to a house in another part of town. And my next door neighbor had a really nice glass backboard in his driveway. And it turns out he had played at UC Davis back in the day. A gentleman named Mike Freeman. Shout out Mike Freeman if you're – I just started – he was very friendly and always let, you know, the neighbor, the kids on the street use the hoop. I was really the only one who took advantage of it a lot. and so that's sort of how I kind of came to do basketball, I guess. Just, you know, shooting in a driveway.
What's the driveway basketball season in Anchorage, Alaska? How long does that last?
Well, it depends on how much you like shooting a cold, wet ball. But it varies by year, but you can really count on it from May to September, probably. But the good news is that it stays light, at least from like June to August. It stays light basically 24 hours. So the limit on how late you can go is is your neighbor saying, "Hey, we're trying to sleep. Stop."
That's funny. That's good stuff. Were you an NBA fan then?
I became one. I mean, I think it was, you got the games on TNT. That was back when, you know, they had the Superstation. So I saw a lot of Hawks games, but also, what was it, WGN.
Bulls, yeah.
Yeah, so got to see a lot of Bulls. And you know, this was late 80s, early 90s. Not a bad time to get to see every Bulls game.
Good time to get to see Bulls games, no question about that, no doubt.
So... yeah, I would say. I mean, at that time, I was probably more split between the NBA and college basketball than I am now. There used to be a tournament that they got held every year at Thanksgiving in Anchorage called the Great Alaska Shootout. And up until they changed kind of the rules for preseason tourneys in like the mid 90s, it was really a destination tournament. Because I think at one point the rules would be like you could go to Hawaii, Alaska, or Puerto Rico only once every 4 years, but like each of them you could go every 4 years for like extra games earlier in the season, and then they changed it that you could like go to one every other year or so. I don't remember exactly what it was, but basically it went from, hey, Alaska has this sort of exemption, to you're picking between like Alaska and the Bahamas or Hawaii, and you know,
understandably, where teams decided to go.
Yeah. So, but the long-winded way of saying, like, we got really good teams up there. So that we saw some, you know, we saw some really good players up there. I mean, Purvis Ellison played like the Louisville players the year he was the number one pick. My freshman year of college, when I wasn't actually there, we had UConn when they were a preseason top five, possibly preseason number one with Ray Allen. You know, so that there was like great teams up there. So we got to see a lot of pretty high quality college basketball in person, despite being in Alaska. So it was split. But then at a certain point, like the college game became, to my mind, substantially less aesthetically pleasing than the NBA game.
It's completely different. I think I'm right there with you. I'm a little bit older than you. I'm 52. And growing up for me, sort of in the heyday of college basketball. And I would say I was definitely clearly on equal ground with college basketball and NBA basketball. And I used to know all the guys coming up through high school and then know when they were in college. And now I look at college basketball and I barely know anything. Guys, the best players are obviously either there for a year, or now they got other options for places that they can go. And so you don't get to know them in the same way. And then you just look at the NBA and how good those players are. And then you watch a college game, and it's kind of jarring actually in some ways to watch a college game after you used to watching so much NBA, just because the guys are so skilled that you go back and watch college and you're like, oh my gosh, like, and you forget how good those players are. And I was a college basketball player, but it was a different time without question. Growing up in Alaska, how'd you work on your game besides in the driveway, trying to get better and improve? Because I know you at least took a shot at college basketball too. So just how'd you work on your game in Anchorage, Alaska?
I mean, did that. Went to some camps in the summer, played a ton. At a certain point, I actually played both hockey and basketball growing up. And at a certain point, you just kind of have to pick one or the other because of the same season. And I decided, perhaps wisely, I think I was 12 when I was either 12 or 14, and it's like, you know, my body feels terrible after every hockey season, so let's, you know, and now with like sore ankles and hips and knees, it's like, okay, well, maybe it didn't matter, maybe basketball was bad for it too, but I just played a ton. Whenever we played at lunch at school, we played after school sometimes. There was some open gyms I went to. Actually, the neighbor whose hoop I learned on, he had kind of a regular game at like a middle school twice a week that he let me and one of my high school teammates come play at, which was a very different game. I mean, obviously we're playing with guys who were, you know, we're high schoolers playing with guys who are 35 and up. So it's a very, very different game. Like much more cerebral, much more skilled, there were some good players, some good athletes in that game. But, you know, obviously, people on the backside of that rather than on the way up, like you would get in like a more of a high school open gym. So that was an interesting learning experience, certainly in terms of learning, like not just like the skills, but sort of how to play. Because these were guys who, you know, had been playing for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. So there was a lot of, you know, well, you set the screen, you slip there, and you know, you look for that pass there and dump it in, kick it, pick it out, repost, all sort of those subtleties that you don't really learn if you're just playing with, you know, with teenagers all the time necessarily.
Kids miss out on that stuff today because they don't get an opportunity to play against older players. Everybody's going through the travel and AAU system where you play against your own age in a gym with a referee, with your mom and dad in the stands, with a scoreboard, with a coach. And kids, I think, miss out on some of the things that you're describing that helped you to become a better player. And I think helped kids in past generations. That's how they learn the game, as opposed to the way we learn it today, where you're just with a skills trainer and you're working on more of those skills in isolation. And then you're playing against kids your own age. And I think it's interesting when we talk to different coaches about how they view that in terms of development. They talk a lot about how kids are probably more skilled if you just put them in a gym and put them through a workout, that kids look better. There's a lot more kids that can shoot the ball. There's a lot more kids that can handle the ball. But when it comes to their basketball IQ and their feel for the game, I think a lot of coaches feel like it's not quite what it was because kids aren't having those experiences that you had.
No, I think this is there's a broader kind of across sports. I'm a big soccer fan, and my day job is in part working for a soccer data company. It's called StatsBomb. So we a big criticism of why, like, the U.S., despite soccer being a hugely popular sport at the youth level here, hasn't produced that many world-class players is just that. It's everyone's coming up through this very regimented business, not, you know, like kids in Brazil aren't going through a pipeline, they're playing soccer. And I think that's a you know, what you're describing with the AAU circuit is, yes, there's some training and some development and some kind of sorting onto all-star teams and stuff that is happening, but first and foremost, it's a business for adults to make money on. And so the business sometimes takes precedence over, you know, how do we get the kids to learn how to play basketball, if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. And I think that a lot of it is money driven and a lot of it is adult driven, as opposed to it being kid driven the way it would have been in the past where a kid goes out and picks up a ball because it's fun or because they're playing with the neighbor or because they're in somebody's driveway. Whereas now it's mom or dad saying, hey, we're getting in the car and we're taking you to basketball practice or we're taking you to soccer practice and you're going to have a coach there and this is the way we're going to teach you. And there's only one way to do it because this is the way the coach wants it done or this is the way the parent wants it done, as opposed to the creative way that kids may have learned that game in the past, or like you're describing with soccer in Brazil, where kids are just picking up the ball and they're playing in the street or they're playing on a field and there's nobody instructing them on what to do. They just have to kind of figure it out. And I think that's something that's been lost in basketball. I'm not sure exactly what the overall impact is on the game, but I definitely know that the development system that we have today is much different. And I don't know what the impact of it is, but it's just a different way of going through and growing up in the game. When you think back to your time as a high school player, do you have a favorite memory as a high school basketball player, something that stands out?
I mean, that's an easy one. I think I referenced it in the book a little bit. We played my senior year. We played a tournament in San Diego. I think it was hosted by Torrey Pines. And if we'd have won our first round game, I would have had to guard Stephon Marbury in the second round, which would not have gone well for me.
Hey, it might have. Shh. No, don't tell anybody.
It would have been. He was like, you know, we watched kind of all of their. It would have been ugly. But in one of the consolation games in that tournament, I got pretty hot. I think I'm remembering I hit something like 6 threes in the second half of a game, and. So my coach always pronounced my game Seph, my name Seph, as S-E-P-H, and he had handwritten the roster that he sent into the tournament, and so somehow in like the game notes in like the program, my name would be changed from Seth Partnow to Sepik Parthenon. And just as I'm hitting these shots, I'm running, and I hear the announcer just struggling with whatever this name is supposed to be, and just so that's my favorite memory of playing in high school, is just hearing the guy just give up and say three Sepik.
That's good stuff. That's funny. It's always nice to be able to bang home 6 3.5. Nothing wrong with that.
One of I still remember this. One of them I got fouled on. It didn't get called, and I banked it in from straight on, which people who follow me on Twitter will think is funny. Nobody hates the banked in three more than me.
I have a daughter who's a senior in high school who she stopped playing as a freshman, but she played AAU and travel basketball as a kid. And then I have a daughter who's in sixth grade who's doing the same thing. And I always say to my assistant coaches in girls basketball that there's a banked three corollary in girls basketball that you never want the game to be close enough at the end where a banked three can beat you. So that's my banked three corollary for girls basketball, because I feel like, especially in the youth level, you just, all these crazy things can go on and you could do tons right. And sometimes the ball just doesn't go in. And then other times you get beat by a banked three. So my goal at the end of games is always to avoid the situation where you could get beat by a banked in three.
You know, that applies to the NBA level too, because you know the best way to not lose close games is to not play close games.
Absolutely, no question about that. You just get yourself a 10-point lead in the fourth quarter. Things look a lot better coming down the stretch.
Exactly,
your clutch numbers look a lot better.
You know what the best clutch number is zero for clutch minutes, because the game wasn't close.
Correct,
enough.
Exactly. you're good enough that you don't even have to play. You don't even have to play clutch minutes. All right, so. You went to Carleton.
The guy who was my coach at Carleton, Guy Calland, literally just retired like 2 weeks ago. Basically, I went to his kind of retirement thing in Northfield, and he had been the coach I think for 34. That doesn't even 34 years. I think he was the coach there, and just got his 500th win this year, and is stepping back. And he and his wife are going to do some traveling, and so it was fun to get back and just see. You were mentioning about the training. I was remembering back. It's Carleton's a D3 school. We had, you know, our best player was a 6'8" All American who he obviously could dunk easily, but we didn't have a ton of guys who could dunk easily, and then. We're at this dysfunction, and the current team is playing, you know, captain's practices, and like everybody on the team is just, you know, one two step RAM. It's just like, well, yeah, that's different training than we had, you know, back when we were, you know, the kids are like the same size as we were. It's just they can all, but we knew how to play better, obviously, because we had just, no, I'm kidding. They would kill us. They would murder us.
It's a different level of athleticism. No question. Yeah. No question. Did you ever at any point consider coaching?
Not really. So when I finished, I graduated with a degree in economics. I only – so it's a – Carleton's a pretty academically rigorous school. I was – you know, I was a bad D3 player in that I – like if I'd have – you know, stay like if I'd have committed myself and worked really hard and got in the gym and in the weight room, I could have played 10 minutes a game my senior year. And I decided to kind of do college a little more instead. And that was probably a more enjoyable. So I played my first 2 years. So or was on the team is probably the better way of putting it. So I, at that point, like continuing like life with basketball as anything other than a fan wasn't really on my radar. Looking back, if it was something that I decided I'd wanted to do, I probably, it was the kind of thing where I probably had the connection through the school, through the coachings at the school to, you know, get a look as an intern or GA or something somewhere. But it didn't even occur to me that that's something one could do. There's a kid who, or is a guy, he's not a kid now, he's probably about 30. Well, he's in his early 30s. Jonah Herskew is an assistant coach for the Kings, who his first 2 years he was at Carleton and played there, and he knew he wanted to coach, and so he like through Coach Callen, who just retired, like basically got his name out there to everybody and kind of did the thing where he, you know, was a GA and then hooked up with a G League team and did like, you know, was the intern at a G League team and then got a gig as in the film room with a WNBA team and then moved up to like an assistant coach with that and then ended up back at with the Lakers as in a film role and then with the Kings in a film role and now was an assistant coach. So like, yes, that path probably was something I could have attempted, but it didn't even occur to me that that's something one could do.
What were you thinking you wanted to do?
I had no idea. I still have no idea.
I'm with you. Yeah. I'm with you 100%.
No, I graduated with a degree in economics, and I, you know, the career center at school was pushing everyone towards management consulting because I think that's where you could get the big alumni donations on the back end. So that didn't seem like a great life. So I worked for a startup for a couple of years. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but, people who are, you know, old enough remember that, the startup, economy got pretty rocky, you know, right around the mid 2000. And I was part of that and I wasn't really loving the job anyway, but I got laid off and didn't know what to do with myself. So bounced around and like temped for a while and then decided to go back to school, went to law school, which I wouldn't recommend unless you're sure you want to be a lawyer. I was a lawyer for a little bit. I didn't like being a lawyer. But while I was in law school and early in my, I discovered I had a talent for playing poker. So I quit my law job and played poker professionally for a couple of years. All the while I was still doing like basketball stuff. Played very regularly. Actually, the best I ever was at basketball was probably the summer before I started law school. I was playing noon ball at like one of the local health clubs and I just stayed after because I, you know, had quit my job just to take the summer off before school and, you know, was shooting around afterwards and, you know, all the bunch of like very tall, very fit guys walk in and start like warming up and shooting. And it turned out it was like a regular game for a bunch of like Minnesota area, like, you know, lower level NBA prospects and European, you know, like EuroLeague level guys and stuff
right,
like that
right.
were from the area. And they were what, you know, they had a regular game and they had nine. So they were like, well, come on. And I was, you know, by far the worst player on the court. But I played really well, made some shots, didn't do anything stupid, and you know, so well, you know, we play at these times, keep coming back, and I played in that game like three times a week that whole summer, worst player on the court every day, and I got so much better at basketball that summer. Just to hold my own, I had to play out of my mind. It was so much fun, and I was in the best shape of my life, and was actually like good at basketball, like good for what felt like the first time. But that was, it was a fleeting moment in time.
It's like real estate, right? You buy the smallest house in the best neighborhood, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's the way you go. That's the way you got to go about and approach it. How'd you know you were going to be good enough to be a professional poker player? Where were you playing poker that you were able to even discover that?
I just kind of was messing around online was playing in like some small tournaments and playing in some cash games. And it's like, hey, I'm winning more than I'm losing. And then I'm winning a lot more than I'm losing, and then I'm paying my grocery bills through this, and so when I eventually had quit my law job, I was playing part time, but I was making it was a good law job, but I was making more money playing poker than I was at the law job, which I hated. So it was kind of easy calculus. I wasn't actually planning for it to be like. Wasn't planning on doing it like full time. As long as I did, it was sort of, well, I know I can make enough money to support myself while I'm looking for the next job, and the next law job just didn't happen. So then at a certain point, even before kind of the U.S. cracked down on all that, all the poker, I kind of burned out on it and decided to do other stuff and got into kind of doing educational consulting in Alaska, which was a reasonably low lift job. So that was when I started writing about basketball. Like I was saying earlier, I had been involved with basketball. I'd been watching a bunch, playing fantasy, playing. If you remember What If Sports, I loved that. I was in a super involved dynasty keeper salary cap fantasy league that was actually. The claim to fame of that league is actually three future NBA heads of analytics played in that league. So, and none of us knew it at the time. It was sort of a random connection that one of the guys had from his college days. He ran into someone he knew from his college days at Summer League and kind of was able to pitch that team some stuff. And so two other guys got a job with them, and one of them is still in the league. Keith Boyarski is the vice president of something or other, strategy and research, I think is his title, with the Raptors. So that was when I started like writing about basketball. I knew I had some people who were already in the league who I could bounce stuff off of. And am I just like completely full of it? Is this any good? So it was helpful to have like, no, this is legit. So you're doing okay. It was nice to have that. But then when I started writing that was right when the NBA's tracking data came out, and it seemed like I was kind of the first person to use the publicly available stuff in a interesting way. And so that meant that like both kind of like more prominent writers, Chris Herring, whose Knicks book I hope you've read.
Yes.
It's phenomenal.
Blood in the Garden. Yeah, it's a great book.
He was kind of the first really high profile national writer to I showed him some stuff, and he's like, you did this? This is really good. And that was, some other folks, Kevin Arnovitz and Zach Lowe, were very supportive early on. So I kept at it. And then at a certain point in that really early on, I started getting random messages from guys at NBA teams. This was when the analytics departments were fairly nascent, and in some cases it was a scout who knew how to use Excel. So it's like, hey, I'm trying to figure out how to do this. Can you? It's like, yeah, well, sure. And at a certain point, these can you do me a favor became conversations, and these conversations then turned, and then I got offered early 2016. I got kind of offered a job with the Bucks, and so. My family, we moved from Anchorage to Milwaukee, where I still live. I was old enough at the time and had enough kids at the time that, the entry level intern job wasn't something that I was going to be able to take. So they were the team that sort of created a position that was at a level that I could say yes to, and took that job and did that for 3 years. As I'm sure you're aware, the professional, and professional meaning, like, you know, I consider college basketball professional basketball as well, in this sense, and that's a hard lifestyle, and it's especially a hard lifestyle to drop into already kind of having a fully formed family.
Absolutely.
It's like, it is the epitome of the, you know, the boil a frog slowly or drop a frog in a pot of boiling water. Like, my wife and I jumped with our eyes open into a pot of boiling water, and it's like, oh wow, this is hot. So after three seasons, it was time to do something different for family reasons as much as anything else. I was, you know, when I left the Bucks, my kids were 5 and 3, and I had been missing a lot of stuff, and you know, wanted to still do basketball stuff, and I was fortunate enough that I had, you know, talked to some of the folks high up at the Athletic when they were just starting, and so when I was thinking of doing something else, I kind of reached out through a friend who worked there, and you know, if I was thinking of making a change, would you be interested? And they were like, yes, hell yes. And so kind of worked something out pretty easily and made that move and sort of did that for, you know, did that full time for a couple of years. And then last summer I was started to branch out. Now I, you know, work for a data company, still contribute to the Athletic, and kind of also had time somewhere in there to write a book.
All right, we're gonna dive into the book. All right, so I want to work backwards to, sure, when you first start writing about the league. What are some of the things that when you first start writing, you're looking at the data that becomes publicly available for the first time? What are some things that you're seeing, and what was your process like for trying to put maybe what you were seeing visually with what the data was saying? What were some of the first things that you noticed, or the first trends that you tried to spot, or just what was your process early on?
So there's several different ways that it sort of happened. Like, one was that was around the time when people started talking about rim protection as a thing. Like, people had talked about protecting the paint, but specifically like rim protection, like making guys miss at the rim. And we finally had data to sort of look at that. Like, block shots are just a little too binary to really, you know, you block a shot or you don't. Sometimes a shot doesn't go in and they credit you for a block when you never touched it. But if you look at, like, if you can see, these are all the shots I defended at the rim and these are how many they made, whether I touched the ball or not. Now, all of a sudden, over a decent sample, it turns out that's a pretty repeatable skill year after year. So you have a pretty good sense of who actually is, you know, the best at you know, suppressing opponent shooting at the rim. And, you know, in those early days, it was, you know, a lot of who you'd expect it to be. It was Andrew Bogut. It was Roy Hibbert was like the master of it. Draymond Green was surprisingly good at it. And then there were some other guys whose reputations probably exceeded their abilities. Like, DeAndre Jordan was actually, for the first couple of years of tracking data, was actually kind of mediocre in terms of suppressing opponent shooting. So that was, so, but messing around with that and trying to find a way to contextually compare one player to another, I came up with like a point saved metric, which I think was pretty good, actually. It's actually, in some ways, being limited to the public data made it easier to get to a certain spot. I found when I tried to recreate it and make it better with like the full data we have at the NBA, there was actually too many hard decisions to make, and I felt like I was making the metric worse by adding more info, which is funny.
I'm sure that probably happens though sometimes, right?
Oh yeah,
absolutely. You could just get buried in data, and it's like, hey, maybe we just need to cut this back to the main thing.
Well, there's sort of a myth that using data is objective, and it's like, oh, this model clearly says that. Well, that model is the product of, you know, 100 tiny decisions, all of which are value judgments about what's important in basketball. So that's not objective. It's consistent in that it expresses like this opinion about how basketball works, but that opinion about how basketball works isn't in any way objective. So like, more data making stuff gives you more chances to make mistakes, even if like a higher degree of description or prediction is possible. But anyway, that was sort of one avenue because I knew that was a topic. Another one is I was just kind of, man, it sure seemed, I was looking into some stuff and looking at, like, Kyle Korver seemed to be open on a whole lot of his corner threes. And I was like, wow, that's really weird. Kyle Korver's a great shooter. Why is he so open on his corner threes? I wonder who else is wide open on all their corner threes. And then I started looking. It's like, oh, everybody's wide open on corner threes. That's why the corner three is better. Not that it's a foot and a half closer. Is that it's, you know, they're all catch and shoot assisted uncontested threes, like 88%. It might be a little different now that players are shoot a little more aggressively, but like it was something like 88% of corner three attempts were uncontested. Above the break, it's closer to 50-50. So it, like, if you want one reason why corner threes are more efficient, it's that. There's some basketball reasons for that. If the guy's not open, you don't throw it to him in the corner. Why do you want the ball in the corner?
And there's there's a lot less angles for that ball to get to the corner,
yeah,
right?
Right. But there's also a lot fewer angles for a defender to recover to that, which is I think why it tends to be more open. So that was that, and then like coming off of that, looked at some other stuff, and it's like, oh, I bet you that's why the best both bigs and like the best wing players actually don't take a lot of corner threes, because why do you want your big in the corner on offense? Why do you want your best player in the corner? You want your big in the middle or the top of the floor for floor balance reasons, right? That's changed a little bit. Teams have started to find ways to get their center, if they have a stretch five, to get them to the corner. But in general, it's still like if bigs are going to shoot threes, they have to be able to shoot above the break threes, not just corner threes. Because why do you want he can't offensive rebound from there, and he's your big, so he's probably slow. So why do you want him on the baseline when the shot goes up?
It's trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's trade-offs in everything where you look at if you're going to put your big outside the three-point line, then you're inevitably giving up offensive rebounding, or you're in terms of spacing the floor.
Yeah.
There's always give and take depending upon where you're going to put certain types of players and what their ability is to shoot the ball.
But it's great if your big is like above the break. That's great for defensive floor balance. You might be giving up offensive rebounding, but you're not gonna you have rim protection if the other team like tries to fast break, so that's good. So that's that's why bigs being able to shoot above the break is pretty important.
Absolutely.
All this stuff about the corner three was just sort of kind of by accident, and then the other way is I didn't do watch a ton of basketball, and the way I've described it is you know, I don't know if you know how like an experienced card player can spot a marked card. If you flip quickly through a deck, like the marking will like flash. You won't like be able to see like what the difference in the pattern is, but you'll see something was different.
You'll see something off. Yeah.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's, you watch enough basketball, especially NBA basketball, which, you know, there are sort of ways certain things are done, and times like, huh, that looked different. Let me watch that again. Is that a thing? Is that a thing he does a lot? Is that a thing anyone does a lot? Is that good? Is it bad? And so just kind of seeing those oddities, or those things that are unexpected, and trying to figure out if there's a way to interrogate the existing data to find out more about it was the start of a lot of sort of, you know, oftentimes it was just nothing. It was just a weird thing that happened once. But sometimes it was genuinely a thing, and that led to some kind of interesting observations, I thought.
When you started getting calls from people in the NBA front offices, what's your reaction when you get that first phone call from somebody in an NBA front office? Are you like, why are they coming to me? Are you like, hey, maybe I'm really onto something? What was your first initial reaction?
I was like, well, that's cool. the more of the, hey, maybe you're onto something, was actually my wife was like, okay, so obviously you're getting a job in the league. And I was like, what? Why? No. And she's like, no, the amount of time you're spending on this, you're getting a job in the league.
it's not negotiable. Yeah, we've all been there.
This is happening. And she was right, as tends to be the case. So the first couple times it was that. And then I sort of realized I know more than some of these people do. Like, some of these people are genuinely my peers, and some of these people I've learned more about this from a, like, a statistical standpoint then. So I didn't, like, the level of kind of, do I belong here? Once I actually got
that went away pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, that was more in some other areas, but certainly in terms of, like, am I good enough at the analytics to do NBA analytics? That, like, that was never a question by the time I was actually in a position for it to matter.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. When you take the job with the Bucks and you go from having just the publicly available data to the data that teams have access to, we talked about it a second ago that sometimes the data can be overload, but how much data is out there that the teams have access to that the public doesn't, that was immediately eye-opening for you coming into a new position?
So for a lot of stuff, so the public stuff that you get that's derived from tracking data, like on NBA.com, it's a level up than you get from, like, the NBA is a little more detailed. You get this sort of information on every shot in detail, but on aggregate, it tells a very similar story. So that part, but it's some of the other stuff. Especially you dig deeper into whether it's like pick and roll coverages or, there's stuff that's sort of, there's events that have been pulled out of the data. The CEO of Segment Spectrum likes to describe it as pulling basketball words from the data. And so that's one level. But the next level down is just like finding stuff from like the movement of players on the court and creating insights from that. And that was both difficult and fun. It's long enough ago and coaching staffs ago and general managers ago that I'm not giving anything away to talk about it. Like a project we did was sort of, we were looking at, again, as looking at corner threes, it's like, okay, teams close out to corner three shooters. The teams that are best at limiting corner threes versus the teams that are worst, where is that guy starting from? And we found that there was about there was an average point on the floor where like all players started their closeout to a corner three from, and the best teams started about 2 feet closer to the corner, maybe a foot and a half, and the teams that gave up the most corner threes, most corner three attempts, were about a foot and a half, 2 feet further away. So just that, like that was really, that was an interesting kind of almost thing with strategic application. It's like, all right, if I'm here, I can get there in time so the guy won't shoot. But if I'm here, you know, like a half step the other direction, I'm dead. And that was some really, like, how you actually put that into practice is, that's complicated and certainly was above my pay grade. But that's the kind of level of detail you can get into on stuff. And there's examples of that kind of thing all over the game. It's just a matter of figuring out what question you want to ask and then how to ask that question of the data.
When you get an insight like that, what's the conversation like so that it eventually trickles down to the coaching staff? Where does it go? And then obviously, I'm sure that over the course of the last 7 or 8 years, there's been a greater acceptance amongst coaches, GMs of the value of analytics. I'm sure 10 years ago, you would have come with that data and you probably would have been scoffed out of the room. Now, I'm sure that coaches are more receptive, but That being said, I'm sure there are varying degrees of acceptance in terms of, okay, this makes sense, this doesn't make sense. So just what's the process from going to the analytics department, making a discovery that they think is valuable, that they think can help the team, to actually getting that to be executed on the floor with the coach and the players?
That's the secret sauce. Like, I don't know. My job was much more a communications job than it was a technical job.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it you know, people ask me what the difference between like writing for like, you know, at the Athletic and doing stuff for the NBA. The difference is like format. The difference is like bullet points versus prose. Not so much. It's like you're trying to communicate complex ideas succinctly in a way that the non-technical, but subject matter expert, non-technical basketball person, basketball fan, can understand. And you know, it may be simple to say that. It is still a challenge to do it, because especially the deeper you get into some of this stuff, you only have so much attention in terms of explaining how you got there before you lose somebody. But you have to convince them you got there in a way that is like replicable and legit for them to trust what you're telling them. So that's a very tight line to walk, and there's no like one answer. It's a little bit like, you know, feel for the game, right? You gotta get reps, and you gotta be in situations. And there are things I will fully admit that there were probably opinions stated too forcefully early in my tenure, and there were probably opinions stated too forcefully before I got there that I'd already kind of put people on edge. So, you know, if you one thing I definitely learned is if you express it as a basketball concept, it's much easier to get buy-in than if you express it as numbers.
Was there a go-to guy that you knew that if you went with clear communication, that then that coach would sort of be an advocate with the rest of the staff to try to get it implemented? Just how did that work? Was there a go-to guy, I guess, is my question.
How every coaching staff takes that information on differently. I found it was, there's some folks who are assistant coaches still with the Bucks now, who on Mike Budenholzer's staff, who were very, very easy to kind of be on the same page with, because they were film guys at the time we started working together, and they, it was easier for them to understand that, like, the qualitative stuff that they were looking at and the quantitative stuff I was looking at weren't actually different things. Like, and a lot of their qualitative stuff was actually quantitative. It's like, oh, this guy, you know, like, this guy shoots X percentage or something. That's numbers. And a lot of the quantitative stuff is qualitative, in that you're making judgments about like what is good and what isn't, like based on these numbers. And so they understood that we were kind of doing the same thing, and that it was important to merge it all together and kind of feed it up. Because, you know, this is never something, like, it's very difficult to go directly to the head coach and cold with, like, because they, you know, that's a CEO, or at least like the COO of a company. Like, they have too many things going on to be in the weeds of this stuff. So picking out the important bits, like, all right, this is something that would help us. That other thing would help us. The medical team has got something. Our team psych has got another thing. The player agent told me this. Like, there's all these things that are working together.
Right.
That you've got to, you know, and, you know, the front office says, hey, we want to get more of a look at this guy because his, you know, his contract is coming up, or we want to showcase this guy because we maybe want to trade him. So you're balancing all these things and, you know, trying to balance winning tomorrow night against getting your team ready to be ready to be flexible enough for the playoffs and get your young guys ready and manage the minutes. So there's a lot, like, basically this is a lot of things that a coach is worrying about, and so they don't have time to like evaluate like chapter and verse of like a, you know, something that analytics department brings up. So it's gotta boil it down, and it's gotta be sifted through And like people ask, like, so how would you go to a player? I was like, I wouldn't. Like, there are teams that have analytics folks who do work directly with players, but that's a defined position. That's a, like an assistant coaching position. And then like those are, you know, there are people who have, you know, like Dean Oliver, who wrote, you know, basketball on paper, is an assistant coach for the Wizards now. But he played college basketball before he kind of, you know, he played at Cal Poly. So he you know, he has that. Like the other folks who are, there's two other bench coaches in the league who I think are dedicated, like have a legitimate like coding analytics background, and they have like playing backgrounds as well. So being able to bridge that is a specific skill set. But for someone who's like strictly like an in-office analyst, like, you know, you don't talk to players, because I mean you talk to players, but you don't, hey, you want to try this. It's like, no, there's a limited bandwidth that players have to take on messages and execute them at game speed. And, you know, the coach has to decide which are the most important, you know, depending on the player, can be between like 1 and 10 things. You know, some players can take on more, some players can just need like one swing thought. So it's up for the coaching staff, and starting from the head coach, to decide which players need which things and which things they're going to present to them. Like, I can bring the information to you, but you're balancing that with 10 other things, and that's why you get the big bucks to decide which of those is most, will help most win both tonight and over the next, you know, 4 months.
Did it ever go the other direction, where would a player ever come to the analytics department with questions? Did you ever have a player come to you with, hey, I think I'm seeing this, or this is what I think is going on? Do you have data to back that up? Did players ever come to you?
They did not. I think that my guess is that's something that'll start happening more. This is something that has happened in baseball now that we're like, you know, 3 to 4 generations deep into like sabermetrics, is that the players have all grown up with this. So they know, like, okay, they're very familiar. They know everything about spin rates and launch angles, and so that's a language they already speak. And I think it's, you know, we're not too far away, especially if, like, the wearables and, you know, tracking type stuff starts to filter in more into colleges and more into grassroots, that this becomes a thing that players are used to seeing about themselves, that then that'll start happening more. But as of right now, I've heard of it with a few players, but for the most part, no. And that's fine. Like, there's, you know, at some level, a lot of the stuff we do is maybe slightly too abstract to be taken unvarnished directly to a player. Like, the stuff that gets to players is like if we do tendency stuff, like, you know, stuff that was hard to do when you're just charting games. You know, for example, all right, this player, when he's getting a pick and roll on the left side, you know, he rejects the screen 23% of the time, which is the highest in the league. Like, okay, that's something. Okay, I don't lean into the screen. But that's not, so that's part of like a standard report, if a coach wants that on the standard report, not like something you would go, like, it's not something I would choose to go to a player. Hey, we're playing Trae Young today, and Trae really loves to reject screens. Like, that's the, okay. Like, okay.
That's going to come through the coach's filter.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's 17 things we have to, there's you know, I don't want to, I'm certainly not in a position where I want to tell people how to defend Trae Young, you know?
What if, okay, let me ask it this way. If you were, and obviously you're not, but if you were an NBA player, knowing what you know on the analytics side, what's something that you might want to know from your analytics department that you think could be valuable to them as a player? What's a question that a player might want to ask?
Whew. I mean, just, you know, I think getting some, I think I would probably want a better understanding of why the nerds think some things are good shots and others aren't. You know, what are the factors that go into that? And really what you'd find is that they're almost exactly what you think they are. And it's just kind of the weight you put on them. I don't know. We can start to get into stuff about decision making, like, there's some like, you know, reads, like what's the read here? What are the options? What is kind of the, what's the theoretical value of each of those options? And then I don't know, like just knowing, like, all right, if I've got a choice between the skip pass to the corner or dumping it off to the guy in the dunker spot, like all else being equal, which one of those is better? Like that seems like something, if I was a primary ball handler, I'd kind of want to know, because that's an empirical question rather than a theoretical one.
Like, right. And it's something that you're going to face all the time, right? Yeah. It's a situation where you're going to be in. It's repeatable where I'm going to see that over and over and over again. And if percentage wise, I can make the better play more often, then my expected results can be better.
Now, the first thing to do, and then the first thing you tell us, like, throw it to the one that's open, like turnover bad. So don't throw the one that's going to be turnover.
Right.
But all else equal, which one of those is the better choice? Does it matter who the players are? Do you have time in the moment to decide? Ooh, that's Kyle Korver in the corner versus that's Andre Roberson in the corner. Does that change my decision? Yes, it does, because one of them is going to shoot and make it. The other one may or might not shoot. And then, you know, a record scratch that guy doesn't shoot the shot in the corner burns shot clock time. That kills you. Like, this is one of my, I think, one of the things that I quote most often, one of the first things I learned from getting the full tracking data set, is that however you want to define initiating offense, every second earlier in the shot clock you get into your offense is worth 1 point of offensive rating. So it's a hundredth of a point per possession. But if you can consistently get into your offense like 2 seconds earlier over the course of a game, that's basically an extra bucket. That just doing that is worth an extra bucket. Now the spread between teams in the NBA is actually like, that's about as big a spread as you're going to find. But still, that's good to know that there's kind of free money. Just like get into your stuff that little bit earlier.
All right, so let me ask you this. I got a question about that.
Yeah.
So this is something that I think when I look at NBA basketball and I think back to Rick Pitino coming to the Boston Celtics and bringing his full court press to the NBA, and he never really had much success, and part of it may have been just because his players never necessarily bought into it. But when I hear you talking about slowing teams down as far as getting into their offense, if you could make a team work to get the ball up the floor where they're just crossing the half court line at the 8 second mark, where they're not necessarily getting that 8 second turnover, but where they're not even started into initiating their offense until 16 seconds. Why do you think more teams, or is there data to show or support or not support picking up more full court to delay exactly what you just said, to delay teams getting into their actions, which obviously from a defensive standpoint, you're going to be making them more inefficient if you're forcing them to start later in the shot clock?
So I think I think it's something teams do as an adjustment, like in the playoffs. I think like game one of the Celtics Bucks series,
For sure, yep.
And they kind of sprung that on Boston. It's like, oh wow, and then you know Boston kind of part of the reason you don't do it is you saw some of the adjustments Boston took. If the guy with the ball is elusive and fast, you might essentially be turning a dead ball possession, which is very pro defense, into a fast break possession, which is very pro offense. If you do it wrong, or you might pick up fouls 80 feet from the basket, which if you're in the bonus is basically, oh, that's a layup. Here you go. Here, have a layup. I slapped you. Because you know, NBA players shoot 80% from the line. It's tiring. So it's something that is hard to execute over 82 games. Also it's probably a good way to get your ball handler defender killed, because all of a sudden Steven Adams is going to be standing at the top of the key. And you know, and it'll be just the one time where like your big is like trucking back to get on back on defense, and you know, Steven, and so he's not, you know, communicating, he's not up at the screen, and you get your head knocked off. So there's a number of reasons. Like, is it something that teams could do selectively? Is it something that I like to see when like a team like wants to try to walk the dog down the floor to save time and you pressure up and make the guy pick the ball up and run clock? I love it. I also like I enjoy like Ja Morant is one of the first players I've seen do this. Is like I think someone's told him about this because like he'll walk the dog in the second quarter. Like so he started like they're in their offense at like 20 in the half court at like 22 in the shot clock because they roll the ball down the floor and he doesn't touch it and the shot clock doesn't run. So I think it's something teams do as an adjustment, but I'm not sure that.
As a steady diet for 82 games.
Yeah. Like, you know, I imagine, like, next year we'll see, like, New Orleans when Jose Alvarado's in the game. He's probably going to be, like, pressed up on the opposing ball handler a lot because he's going to play 18 minutes. So if he picks up fouls and gets tired, kind of who cares? And maybe if their backup point guard is in the game, we might get some steals. We're certainly going to make them start their offense with, like, 12 on the shot clock. So, you know, that'll be good for us.
No, that makes a ton of sense. And I think you see it, as you said, throughout the playoffs when you're talking about making adjustments and just putting different coverages out there. And especially when you're dealing with superstar players, you got to give those guys different looks because they're just so good. They're so talented. They have such a high basketball IQ that you keep showing them the same thing over and over and they solve it. It doesn't take them very long to solve it and figure out what they want to do.
These guys have played so much basketball. So much like a guy who's been in the NBA for 6 years. Think of how much basketball they've played. Think of how many times they've seen everything. And it's like you're not going to surprise them. Like we might surprise them once, but yeah, right, if there's just someone who's good enough to handle the ball at the NBA, they're going to figure it out pretty quick.
All right, let me ask you about. We just had the NBA draft lottery, and I think if there's one area of sports that continues to be probably the most confounding, I'm guessing, to front offices, especially the NBA draft. If you go back 15 or 20 years ago, there were occasionally players who were drafted in the top 10 who didn't work out. But for the most part, guys were in college for three or four years.
So I'm going to stop you there. And so it's been pretty consistent.
Has it really?
Like, yeah. They're okay. We tend to, I don't know if you have to bleep this on your pod, but the shit happens factor is we forget. Like every player has bust potential. There's no such thing as a can't miss prospect. And so you go back and you find guys every draft. There's, you know, on average going back, I've looked at it going back to like the mid 90s and it's been pretty consistent that like there's a, you know, a quarter of the guys picked in the top five are busts, are just not good. And that hasn't changed.
All right. Now, so with that being said, thank you for correcting me and making me come through with some accurate information. What are teams looking at? Let's start here. Is there things from the college level that are translatable to the NBA? And then conversely, are there things that players do in college that don't translate nearly as well? So is there a particular skill that when you see it in a player in college, you're like, oh, that's going to translate really well? And conversely, is there something that maybe doesn't translate?
So shooting percentage is something that is, you know, we don't have nearly as good information about like the context of a player's shots in college. And we don't like, and part of it is we don't know if like their college team used them in like the right way or something. Like, you know, player who I had a tremendous year this year, who I've been a big fan of since his college days, Robert Williams, like they when he was at Texas A&M, they basically never, ever ran spread pick and roll. Because they had another big who they ran a lot of their offense through, and so he kind of hung out a lot, and so his offensive numbers in college weren't representative of how he'd play in the NBA. In terms of things that do translate, like free throw percentage is one we look at. It's almost a free throw percentage in some ways, depending on how you slice it, is more predictive of whether a guy will be able to shoot threes at the NBA level than their three-point percentage in college. Because, again, we don't know what kind of threes they were taking. that, like, you know, were they, you remember Derek Williams from Arizona?
Absolutely.
He went number two in the draft because he shot like 50 something, like, in large part because he shot like 52% from three his last year of college. But you get in the data, first of all, he took like 1.5 a game and they were all wide open, toes to the line threes. Where you compare that to someone else who's taking, you know, pull up 26 footers, hand in the face, off the dribble. Like, it's a very different shot profile. So how do you compare those two? So free throw percentage. And then the big one, you know, we were talking about, like, okay, the guy's tremendously skilled, but can he play? Kind of the sort of the best proxy we have for can he play is steals. Like, and steals is actually, in again, depending on how you slice it, steals is often more predictive of a player's offensive success at the NBA than their defensive success. Because it's the theory is it's representing some combination of, like, athleticism, functional athleticism, not like combine athleticism, functional athleticism and ability to read the game that basically says, hey, this guy gets to the ball. This guy makes plays on the ball. And so that's something that is kind of important. We got the ball more than you did because our guy, like, 2.5 times a game, as the best steal guys do, like, got to the ball first. That's kind of a big deal. So that's you know, that as a catch-all, we're not exactly sure why, but it sure seems like it means something. Steals. But then you get in situations where only sometimes, like the guys who play at the top of the zone for Syracuse, like they get steals, but they're not the same steals everyone else gets.
Right.
So you got to know that the guys who play at like Virginia or, you know, under Sean Miller at Arizona play a conservative pack line defense. Like, you know, you look at like the steals and blocks tend to be like indicators of athleticism. Aaron Gordon had pretty mediocre steal and block numbers in college. Now, I think you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know Aaron Gordon was and still is a nuclear athlete. But then you realize, oh, the style of defense they played means that, yeah, he wasn't going to get a lot of steals and blocks because they played a very conservative style. So it's not a one-size-fits-all thing, but these are sort of the things that you want to look at. And then just from a you know, perspective of like doing draft modeling, like, do you build that stuff in to your model, or is it just something you kind of know and say, hey, okay, he shows up in our model as not a great athlete, but he also played in this system where we know it suppresses these indicators. So yes, he's exactly the athlete I think we all see on film, because look at these dunks. Or look at his dunk rate, basically. And that, you know, it's an that would be inconsistent, a guy with, you know, huge dunk rate and low steal and block numbers. But if you have a good reason for the low steals and blocks, then you can kind of, the whole story is, like, he's a great athlete who's playing in a conservative system. And,
right.
And that's, you know, that's coherence. And then you kind of go with that. Sorry, I rambled there for a little bit.
No, absolutely not. No, yeah. That was a good answer to the question, because I think when I start thinking about what an NBA team is looking for and how they try to make their evaluation on what the player seemingly does in college, we've all seen, right, college players who have tremendous statistics and are just unbelievable college players, and then that just doesn't translate to the NBA. And then conversely, we've seen players who have been average college players, or certainly not college players that have been stars, that have come into the NBA and vastly exceeded probably what people thought their ceiling was as a college player. And I think that comes back to, and this is to me always the hardest part to evaluate, and I'm sure it's hard for NBA teams to evaluate, is just there's more to it. There's measurables, there's analytics, there's all these things. And then ultimately there's what kind of a guy is that player, and what kind of work ethic do they have? And once they get to the league, are they going to keep getting better, or are they going to plateau once they get there? Were you privy to any conversations about that in terms of work ethic of players, or just trying to evaluate sort of those intangibles as opposed to the measurables?
So those were funny to me, because those are always sort of a Rorschach test, like the same piece of information is if you like the guy, it's a positive. If right. you like, you know, like a play, like the, like I don't remember which like a specific player this was about, but I know this conversation happened somewhere. I'll give a couple examples. One, like a player, like you know, occasionally like gets into it with teammates on the sideline. You don't like the player, he's an asshole. You like the player, he has competitive fire.
Right.
You know, if a player is a musician, also, you know, well-rounded, balanced personality will handle pressures well because he's got like, you know, he's a balanced personality. Or does he love basketball?
Right.
Like, and that's wholly determined by your you know, not wholly, but largely determined by what you think of the player otherwise. And so the same piece of information can easily be made to fit the positive or negative narrative. So yeah. And I will say that like, a lot of what, you know, you try to do using statistics, analytics, whatever, is to try to shrink the zone of that sort of those intangibles. Like, okay, we have their box score stats that only tells us something. It's like, the more we can know about how he got there, how they got there, and how that compares to other players, and how that compares to players who've had success in the NBA and have not had success in the NBA, how it compares to how a player might play in the NBA or doesn't. Like, the more you can start to get into that, as you get the more granular data, you can at least there's still uncertainty because you're trying to figure out what 18-year-old is going to be best when he's 25. And, you know, on top of, like, if you know, if you just left him alone,
right.
like that's hard to say. And then there's all the things that can happen in between injuries and life stuff and the wrong coach and the wrong teammates and the wrong girlfriend and the wrong agent or the right versions of that. You know, like a system where they encourage, no, you can't shoot a three, but, you know, shoot that three. I know you're going to miss it, but keep shooting it. And then 3 years later, you're a shooter. But at least you kind of understand what we're talking about. If you know, okay, well, like a style thing. Like, okay, he got all his buckets by bullying smaller players. Yeah,
right. Is he gonna be able to do that in the NBA? Yeah.
Why is Luka Garza not a first round draft pick?
It's like, right, well, college player of the year, right?
Yeah, but that's not gonna work. Come on. Like, and like, look at the, like, he's going up against, you know, a guy who's going to be a good second division player in Spain, and then he's going to be trying to do it against Bam Adebayo. Like, one of these things is not like the other.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the draft is always, to me, the most interesting piece of just what NBA teams have to do, because you think about everything else, there's – you know, you can spend hours and hours watching film of your own team, of opponents, all those things. And you get those tendencies, and those are things that are happening in the context of an NBA game. So it's clearly transferable. Whereas you watch a player in the college level, and the level of play is completely different, and you just have no idea how that's going to translate. It's always fascinating to me to kind of watch the process and think about where guys are going to go and what's that going to look like. Let me jump to the idea of a player being a clutch player. Tell me what analytics tells us about one player's ability to be, quote, clutch, and another player's inability to be clutch.
So this is one of those things that it's like defined terms. Like, what do we mean by saying a player's clutch? Are we talking about you want him to take the last shot? I can tell you that that's not a thing. Like, if you were to... So I've looked at this a number of different ways, different time scores, but basically like last shot situations, however you want to define it. There's sort of a league average that's been constant over since 1996 when we first have play-by-play data. So I'm going to forget I haven't done this in a minute, so I forget the exact, but it's something like, I think it's under 30 seconds shot to take the lead or tie. The league overall shoots about 30%. In those, as the number of players, shots any individual player has taken, they all start to converge around 30%. Like, yeah, there's some guys above, but they've taken like 35 career shots and have hit like two extra. So it seems like they're a huge outlier. So, like, in terms of, like, that situation, like, that's a shot that just doesn't go in for everybody a lot. And it's like, you know, like, if you look at it, like, Kobe and LeBron are both, like, dead on that, like, line of league average over, and they like, them and Russell Westbrook are the ones who I think have taken the most shots in that situation, if I remember correctly. And it's just, like, absolutely dead on the line of you know, having converged to the you know, the sample mean, as we would say. So on that, like, narrow slice of it, clutch isn't a thing. Amongst the set, like, I'll say it this way, amongst the set of players who are deemed to be good enough to take that shot, does not seem like there's a lot of differentiation just in terms of he's going to make that last shot more than the next guy.
It's almost the number of shots that they take.
Yeah.
Because in order to be able to even have the opportunity to take a clutch shot, you have to be a guy that can create and get to that spot or get open or be the guy that your team wants to be in that position. So it's almost like the raw number of how many attempts do you have tells you a little bit more about the clutchness.
Yeah, no, it's he played for 20 years and had the ball in his hands a lot, so he took a lot of those shots.
Exactly. Yeah.
So but then, you know, we start to talk about, like, some other, like, if you broaden clutch out, and then we can watch, you know, it's something that drives me crazy watching playoff games, but, you know, 5 minutes left in a close game, what do most teams do? Walk the ball down the floor and dribble at half court for 10 seconds. So what kind of shots are you getting off those? You're getting mid-range pull-ups. So, yeah, the guys who are better at mid-range pull-ups are going to be better, relatively better, when that's the only shot anyone's taking than if, you know, that's less true for a team that just sort of does this, what I consider the smart thing, kind of keeps running offense, which up until, like, a week ago, I would have said, like Phoenix does, but then they...
So what's the thought process? Why, when you get down into that late clock situation at the end of the third quarter and a team gets the ball with 22 seconds left on the shot clock, why do they come down? This is the question I always have asked myself in that situation. When I'm sitting there and I'm watching a game on TV or I'm in the arena and I see that, I always ask myself, if this is the best way to score a basket, then why aren't we doing this for the entire game? And the answer obviously is it's not the best way to score a basket, but what's the thought process? Why do teams do that?
So you're in most possessions, you're not actually trying to, what's the best way to score a basket? It's what's the best way to outscore the other team. Now, for most of the game, that's the same question. Like, we get to take the best shots, we'll score more.
Right.
We'll figure the defense out on the other end. Now, in a situation like that, I mean, the best way to outscore the other team is not let them shoot at all. So, like, you get back, so the
worst case scenario is 0-0.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why, you know, end of the fourth quarter, like, okay, tie game, end of the fourth quarter, why do they just dribble the clock out and take a contested pull up? Well, taking losing in regulation off the table is a massive improvement in your win probability. So, like, there's an interesting, like, it's an interesting thought game that, you know, the nerds occasionally have when we get together, which is, okay, we know it's very, like, the most important thing in that, like, tie game, end of the fourth quarter, is the shot, like, the ball in the air at 0-0-0, point 0-0, or whatever, like, or thereabouts. How good a shooter does the guy have to be if you get an open corner three with 10 seconds on the clock? Because, like, it's a great shot, but you're still going to miss that shot 60% of the time. And now you've given the opponent, even if you make it, the opponent has a chance to tie. And if you miss it, like, the 6 out of 10 times you miss it, the opponent now has a chance to win in regulation. So how good do you have to be at making that shot for it to be right to take that shot versus, like, I'll throw the ball back out to our main creator? For it to be, you know, theoretically correct. And that's it's a tough problem.
Is there an answer to it?
I don't have one. Like, we've gone back and forth because then you get into a little bit of the psychology of, I know I'm not supposed to shoot this, but I'm open, so I'm going to shoot it. Okay, if that's your thought process, is your shooting percentage really your shooting percentage? You know, if you haven't, like, if you're in a situation where I know this isn't the right thing, or is it? Like, you have to think that plausibly affects the shooting percentage of a player. Now, and then you go one even further, and now it's like a thing, so now teams know that, hey, the guy, it's wrong for the guy in the corner to shoot, so we're going to run and jump every time. Well, if it happens a bunch of times, then all of a sudden the guy in the corner knows, I'm just going to shoot this because they ran and jumped. Now he's shooting his normal shot, and so it's, you know, the math changes again because of, like, the familiarity with the situation. So it's you can layer and layer things on top of it, and it's you know, and the answer is I don't know, but there's a lot to think about.
Definitely, when you're considering what the right approach, the right strategy, that's always one that I think is. What would you find in a situation where teams up three, and they're on defense? They obviously, do you foul or do you let them play out their offense and try to shoot that three to tie it up?
I mean, the correct play is to foul because, you know, taking the one possession tie off the board. Executing that is harder. And I think my strong impression is I don't think teams practice those kind of situations enough. I don't think teams practice how to give the foul and when not to give a foul in a we're up three, we're going to foul situation.
The Marcus Smart play with the Bucks, right? Where he only got two free throws, but that could have very easily been called a three-shot foul.
Well, not just that. Like, you know, if you're up three and a guy catches the ball inside the arc, why are you not tackling him? Like, and it just, you see teams run like a, like, this is, you know, they're running a sideline out of bounds. The number of times I see a team enter the ball to a guy at the elbow and run like a split action or something like that, it's like, just run through his back. Like, you know, sorry, you're shooting two free throws, my bad. Like, right. that they can't possibly hurt you. So, like, it's not the sort of thing where you practice a specific given scenario. It's just like, in general, if we're trying to give a foul to avoid the three, we're going to practice when to do it, when not to do it, just for a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's interesting. I think that's a debate that I hear oftentimes, whether you look on social media or wherever, or just coach discussions with high school coaches. I think there's a ton of discussion about should you foul, should you let it play itself out. And I think one of the worries, and this is exactly what you're describing with NBA players, so you can imagine it goes 20-fold for high school players, that you have no idea what those kids are going to do and how they're going to foul, right? It's like right. I could go tackle somebody and get called for an intentional foul. And now I've put my team in a really bad spot.
Not just, I mean, I, frankly, it's not just the high school players, the high school refs also.
Right, true. That's true. Like, no question about that. Yeah. No doubt about that. But that's always a situation where anytime that comes up, if you're sitting with somebody else watching a game on your couch or at a bar or in the arena or whatever, inevitably the people that are you're sitting with, everybody's turning to each other going, do you foul here? What do you do? Do you let them, do you play it out? Do you foul?
And so the answer is if you can, yeah. And, you know, and it's again, just like, I don't think, cause it's something that happens often, but not like super commonly. So I don't think anyone has, I don't think most, like, that's one situation where like most players don't have enough reps to like intuitively understand, all right, I can foul him and he can't get a shot off.
Well, and you also have to have, you're taking into account, as you said, with the high school, but NBA is the same way, right? If I'm in an NBA setting and I'm going through and trying to put NBA that players, in practice, right? I don't know what the ref's going to call. So yeah. I can practice it and I can still look and go, ooh, maybe that would have been called a shooting foul. Or maybe that's it, just, there's a lot of variables that go into that for sure.
Yeah. No, I think, and in general, I think that, This is me getting hot takey, I think, but I think that there's something like, you know, baseball people do where it's like, okay, down 3-2 in the eighth inning, bottom of the eighth, one out, man on second. you know, left-handed throwing left fielder, and they, you know, they come up and like, do you send the runner or not? And they come up with all the, and they like talk through all these scenarios like endlessly. I'm not sure that it's as much a part of basketball coaching to pre-decide like end of game stuff. Like, do you foul? Do you have to shoot a three here? Can you go for a quick two? Can you, you know, when do you use your timeouts? I don't know if that like the, because there's too much going on in
it's
the moment.
It's more dynamic, right? It's more dynamic. Baseball is a lot less dynamic.
Well, no, but there's too much going on in the moment to make the decision in the moment. So you have to almost run a bunch of those scenarios a bunch of times in your head even to figure out, okay, this is how we handle that scenario. And then like be able to have already decided that when the scenario occurs in a game. And I kind of feel like that's something that doesn't happen enough because I generally am very deferential to coaching just because it's hard. That's one spot where I see a lot of things that I think are just like objective mistakes, like in terms of like timeout usage and whether to go for a three and you know, when to start fouling and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, special situations where scenarios that have been repeated in games where like, okay, we're down six with a minute and a half to go. Does it make sense to keep playing or does it make sense to foul at this point?
Yeah. It's you know, there's most of coaching is like, you know, cooking. It's a pinch of this, a dash of that.
Right.
You know, taste it. How does it how are we going? Like a lot of these more like discrete scenarios are more like baking, where, you know, you a third of a cup of this and then so you can come up with a recipe, and sticking to it will over time lead to better results.
You see it a little bit with the NFL, right? With third down, you know, going for it on fourth down and the charts and things that they refer to, and coaches do it by feel.
No, but those charts and stuff are an attempt to have decided beforehand.
Correct.
When you actually have time to think about it in a depressurized, de-emotionalized situation.
Correct.
Like it's you know, it is not possible for 90-something% of even like the most experienced, highly intelligent, high feel, high understanding individuals, like doing that in the moment is too big an ask.
Yeah.
Like considering all those things in the moment is too big an ask.
Yeah, I agree. There's moments where you'll watch and you'll look at it and you'll be like, why did they do that? And
it happened too fast.
Yeah. And you forget when it's, I always say it's really easy to coach from the couch or coach from the bleachers. It's super easy because you might only see one thing. You might be looking at one thing, whereas that coach is looking at 25 things and you end up making the best choice that you can in the moment. And sometimes it ends up being the wrong choice.
Right. So this is something really interesting. I was reading. Are you familiar with Doug Lomov's? He is a So something I was in his book that is about simplifying. I think it was his book where he was talking about they did like vision studies of like just of good professional soccer players versus elite ones.
Right.
And you kind of would expect, okay, well, the elite one sees everything, so he's looking everywhere. It's like, no, the elite one is looking at a few things intently.
Right, can block out what's extraneous,
or has learned like what the tells are, what the patterns.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, there's all this information and learned which parts of information matter and which can be ignored, and that's
the Albert Pujols batting against Jenny Finch, the softball pitcher, and she's throwing underhand and he can't catch up to the pitches because he's learned how to read the cues from somebody throwing overhand from 60 feet or whatever, you know, 60 feet, 6 inches. And now suddenly you put somebody on the mound that he should theoretically be able to hit, but all the cues are different.
Yep. That's not to go, this is in baseball, there's like the tunneling thing. Like people think it's really cool that like, if all your pitches start out in the same place and then you know, they do these overlays where, okay, the slider goes this way and the fastball goes this way. And it's like, does that matter? Or because Is the pit hitter reading slider because the ball is going so, or is he reading slider because he's picking up something about the way your elbow like came up when you were, you know, so, and so if it's the latter, which I think is frankly is more plausible, given the time you actually have to react, the ball started there, but it's going to be here because I know this is a slider. And obviously that's not a conscious thought that's happening. But
right,
so anyway,
right. That's intuitive. That's just, you've had so much experience that your body just, it becomes almost instinctual at that point.
So, my point being there is like, there's 25 things, but if you get the reps, you can, okay, that doesn't matter. 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 This is what matters. That's my decision. Like if you can simplify it down, you have a better chance of making the right decision.
Yeah. And doing it, as you said, in a depressurized situation where you've already thought through the situation that if we get in this exact scenario, here's what we're going to do. And then you just revert back to the time when you already figured that out. You don't have to react in the moment. And then you end up making a bad decision based on what the circumstance is.
Right. Yeah. And afterwards, like, oh, I should have, blah, blah, blah. It's like, and it's, you know, it's hard. And, you know, frankly, there weren't the tools to really be able to study those things in detail are still reasonably new.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you know, again, we've only had like reliable play-by-play data at the NBA level since, you know, the late 90s. We don't really have reliable play-by-play data for most other leagues now. Certainly not at the high school level.
Right, absolutely.
So how do you study, like, you know, the scenario if you don't have the sort of historical outcomes to, okay, well, you know, what is the value of being down two here versus being down three here?
Right.
You know, is like... Like, you know, the change in win probability of getting the quick two versus, like, in general, the quick two doesn't, it just helps you lose a little bit slower because it doesn't actually move the needle very much. Whereas like tying the game, good. But you have a better chance to tie. You can get the two and they miss a free throw. Then you make a three and tie. It's like, yeah, but then you go to overtime and lose half the time anyway. You're not playing for overtime. You're playing to win anyway. That's I'm still scarred from the tournament this year where, well, they don't need a three here. It's like they're down five with 10 seconds left. They need a three here. Like,
yeah, you can only bang home so many twos and then hope that the team's going to miss fouls. Yeah, I guess you get one out of 20 times. Maybe that works. But yeah, generally speaking, three is worth more than two, and you're going to come back a lot quicker.
Yeah.
If you're banging home threes.
This isn't completely accurate, but it's closer to right than it is wrong. If you're ever in a situation where you're asking, do we need a three here? The answer is yes. If you get to the point where you're asking the question, you might actually be too late.
Good ground rule. Good ground rule. All right, let me ask you this. If you are a high school coach and you don't have access to all the data that obviously is available at the NBA level, because we got a lot of high school coaches that are part of our audience, and you want to think about a stat or two that you found over your experience truly impacts winning, what are one or two things that a coach who has limited access to data could look at that could help them to win more games?
So I think that I love this question. It's a great question that I get. I think that, you know, you're comparing to what the NBA has is not, you know, it's going to drive you crazy.
For sure.
You're looking for better. And so, like, what's the first step of better is, like, how do we, like, to me at least, there's a couple different ways. Like, how do we do when we run play X, Y, or Z? Or how do we do when this group is on the floor, this guy is on the floor, this combination of three players on the floor? So, like, tracking those things, charting those things, I feel like will give you much more information about how your team does, and then give you some more like almost process notes about, okay, well, when we, and if you could somehow do both, like chart plays by what lineup is in the game. It's like, okay, well, when we run flex with our backup point guard in the game, we only score 0.6 points per possession, but we run it with our starting point guard in the game, it's like 1.1. Okay, so let's run out of something else when our backup's in the game or something like that. Now, that's, you know, that's probably something you would do after you've had a season under your belt of figuring out how to chart what you want to chart. But like, pick one thing, pick a couple things you want to know about your team. And if you have the video, just, you know, chart them, have your assistant coach chart them, have a student manager chart them. And that's just more information that you have. And, you know, don't be afraid to change it up if you realize you're not quite capturing the right thing. But as long as you capture that consistently for a given number of games, you can start to see if something matters. Or if it's just something like, oh, well, when we make four more passes, we score more. No, it's actually about the same. Now, if the ball reverse, when we get, you know, one of the assistant coaches I worked with, and I'm sure this is common terminology, but he used to talk about sides. You know, if the ball moves side, if the ball starts to the right side, goes to the left side, comes back to the right side, we had three sides that position. Like, how does our offensive efficiency change when we get multiple sides? You know, again, that's probably something that's a little further down the road for most. But if you collect that data, then you can start to answer those questions. Like, I think it's good when we do X, Y, or Z. Well, now that I've tracked how we actually do when we do these things, like,
right,
you know,
exactly.
You'll be right most of the time, but you'll be wrong enough of a percentage of the time that you'll be glad you looked.
I think that's one of the things that's most interesting when you talk about, especially high school sports, where you don't have access to the same level of statistics. And so much of it is reliant upon the eye test and what you think you see. I think that's so interesting. I know that, speaking for myself as a coach, speaking for myself as a parent, you'll go and you'll watch a game, and the things that you think happened or that you perceived what happens, or the things that you completely forgot that happened, when you go back and you look at those things on film, I'm constantly amazed by some of the things that I see that I didn't see live in the moment. And then you take it the next step further. So that's if you go back 15 or 20 years ago, that's basically what it was, right? Watching film was just going back and using the eye test, but being able to replay it over and over again on the video and see it as many times as you wanted. But nobody was really charting or putting any of this analytics piece of it. And now you have the ability not only to go back and relook at it with the eye test, but you also have the ability to go back and put some actual meaningful data behind it and see, is what I think I'm seeing what I'm really seeing? Is that what the data tells me?
Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of what gets presented as analytics is like fancy models and, you know, machine learning, and a lot of that stuff is frankly marketing fluff. Like, a lot of the most impactful stuff, especially when you're sort of just getting on the curve of using statistics and using data, is fancy counting. You know, you're counting some stuff that you weren't counting yesterday,
right?
And you're looking at it. And that's, you know, that's what charting games is. And people have been charting games for as long as, since we've had like reel to reel, right? And it's just a matter of being systematic about that. And like, you know, having almost a hypothesis, I think this matters, I'm going to collect data and test it. And then you can, you know, you do that and you move on to the next thing. And, or if it's something that is meaningful, then you kind of keep tracking it. And then, like, you know, then deciding whether or not to tell your team you're tracking it is a whole other thing. Cause it's like, you know, there's a chapter in the book about, it's an economics concept called Goodhart's Law, or as every coach would know it, playing the drill. And so if you change the incentive structure so that you actually, hey, we're, you know, the really silly example is high fives. Hey, teams that high five a lot win. So we're counting every time you high five. How sincere do you think those high fives are going to be on that team after the coach says that they're tracking high fives or butt slaps or whatever?
Like, not very, let's put it that way.
So whatever the you know, even if you could like separate, like, well, yeah, the team that's high-fiving a lot wins because they're making good plays. Even if you could separate that out, as soon as you say, yeah, we're counting high fives, then it's like, well, I'm not high-fiving because we did something good, or to try to pick my teammate up, or to say I got you, or to say come on, I'm high-fiving because coach is over there with the clipboard. And so it's, you know, it's not the same thing.
Right. Take it to the same thing with sides, right? You could all of a sudden be like, okay, we want it. The more sides we get, the more, the better, more efficient we are. Well, now all of a sudden we're just whipping the ball back and forth over the center line because we know that's going to make coach happy. It's not necessarily leading to us being a more efficient offense.
When we throw at least five passes, we score more. So I want every possession to start with a three-man weave at the top of the floor.
Old school, we're going Hoosiers.
Yeah, well, I don't think we have time for my Norman Dale rant.
That's a different that's a different era of basketball. It's amazing. Yeah. I tell people, I have this conversation all the time, that like the game that I played as a college basketball player from 1988 to 1992 resembles nothing like what the game looks like today. I don't think if I was involved in five pick and rolls as a player, either offensively or defensively, that was probably a lot in my entire 4-year college career. And I can honestly say that I don't think I ever drove to the basket, ended up in the lane, and then somehow passed the ball backwards out to the 3-point line. I don't think either one of those things ever happened. And the game is just, it's changed so much in the way that it's played. And obviously the data and the analytics and just the fact that 3 points are worth more than two, the fact that it took us so long to discover that is kind of amazing when you really think about it.
It on one level it is. On another, like, again, we didn't have the same time. We didn't have like good play-by-play data at the NBA level. We didn't have good like shot location data. So like, you know, closer shots go in more. So yeah, that shot's worth an extra point more, but how much more often do I make the 15-footer? Than the 24-footer.
And the skill level, especially you go back to, you think of, all right, let's take the mid-80s Lakers and Celtics. Like, sure, if those guys had been working on their threes all the time, they would be just as good as the shooters that we have today. But the reality is, if all of a sudden you said, hey, we need to start taking 50 threes in a game, the percentages that those guys would have shot in that, you know, immediately, now give them 2 or 3 years, they probably would have been able to get there. But if you said immediately, all right, starting tomorrow, you're going to start taking 50 threes a game, those percentages would have been pretty low.
Yeah. But on the flip side of it is like, if you don't know, if you don't have the data, it's like, well, yeah, I make a 15-footer more than I make a 24-footer. Do I make it enough more that like that the 15-footer is a better shot, all else being equal? In the absence of data, the answer could easily be yes.
Right.
It's just once we actually had that data, we found out that, like, you know, at least, you know, with the characteristics of shots as taken in the NBA, like a 15-footer is made like 2 percentage points more often than a 3-pointer. And so it's like, oh, the math isn't actually close. As it turns out, but like before, when we didn't have that data, like that we didn't know that. And we didn't really have any way to know that because nobody was watching, you know, 1,000 NBA games. And like, it's like, oh, well, yeah, this is across the NBA, this is a 42% shot and this is a 37% shot. But the 37% shot is worth, you know, a full point more. So do the math, much more efficient. Like that's almost not the hard part. The hard part was figuring out that, yeah, no, the percentage decline is just not very, like, you know, the percentage NBA player shoots like drops sort of steeply once you get to about 5 feet from the basket and then declines pretty like subtly and like relatively flat until you get up to about 26 feet and then it drops off a cliff again for the most part. But we didn't know that until we had like the data to, you know, there's no reason that was compelled by theory. It's just, it's purely empirical, but we didn't have the data to be empirical about it. So nobody knew. And now that we knew, okay, it probably took a little too long to, you know, to deal with the implications of that. But it's not surprising that people didn't know what they didn't know.
All right, now let's take this. We have blown past an hour and a half. So
I'm sorry.
No, it's great. There's nothing to apologize for. It's been awesome, and I didn't even look at the time until like 2 minutes ago. So that means the conversation has gone exceedingly well. So I want to ask you though. You just talked about the data, and you know, you don't know what you don't know. Where are we with defensive metrics?
Yeah. So no, this is so this is, you know, it's how do you measure what didn't happen? Is and defense is about like not letting things happen. So there's certain, like, you know, we talked about like rim protection earlier, and that's sort of a special case, because in many instances, like, the best defense means the guy doesn't shoot at all, so you can't really use shooting percentage. You know, even for the most part, even a highly contested shot at the rim in the NBA is a decent shot. So kind of no matter who's there, guys will shoot. Guys will try to put up layups. So it's kind of a pure test of like how much an individual player is impacting that percentage. But that's unusual. So almost what we have to do first is we need to come up with a way to systematically evaluate offensive decision making. And then once we know that, then we can start to see how a defender might alter decision making, might make decisions worse or push them in a certain direction. And that's when we can really start to understand things about defense. Now, there are metrics that can sort of say, okay, in the system in which he plays, this guy is probably a pretty impactful defender. We have metrics like that now, and they're fine, but that's not super helpful because it's not portable. It's like the part of these plus minus metrics that gets overlooked a lot is it's not a measure of how good a player is. It's a measure of how impactful he has been in the role in which he's used. And those are two very different things, because one, if a player's good, he's going to be good kind of no matter where he goes. If it's about, like, you know, effectiveness in role, if we put him on a different role in another team, what does the previous thing help you tell you? Now, it'd probably be better that if he was good in another role than not, but, you know, how sure are we that a guy who's a great role player is going to be equally impactful when you make him your primary offensive option? History tells us it doesn't really work out well. You know, we see a lot of ugly shooting percentages when a guy goes from being, like, you know, the third perimeter scorer on a good team to the main offensive engine on a bad team. He'll put up numbers, but his efficiency will be pretty terrible.
Absolutely.
So that's the problem with defense. It's like, okay, he's been good defensively, but we don't really know how or why. So if we add him to our team, will he help us? I don't know. With this sort of top-down metrics. Now, again, there are some specific cases from a statistical standpoint. Like, with a big, you can sort of start to see, like, does he help your rebound? Does he rim? Does he protect the rim? Like, those are things that seem to be portable.
So, like, Evan Mobley for the Cavs this year makes a difference. Jared Allen, those two guys protecting the rim makes a difference in the Cavs defense.
Yeah. Oh, and so, like, I use this example in the book of when we were, like, looking at signing Brook Lopez. It's like, oh, like, Brook Lopez sucks on defense. Remember when everyone thought that?
Right, for sure.
Yeah. And partially it's because when the hotness was, all right, you want your big up to touch and chase the guard out to half court, like your Kevin Garnett. Like that's probably not, does not fit Brook Lopez's physical skill set. It's fair to say, but that's how people wanted bigs to play, and he didn't do that very well. But if you look at it, also he didn't grab a lot of rebounds. But you look at it, his teams always rebounded the crap out of the ball when he was on the floor. He may not get the rebound, but his team gets the rebound. Okay, so he's not going to, like, when we signed him, we had been a mediocre to bad defensive rebounding team. He doesn't get a lot of rebounds, but it'll help our rebounding because he'll at least prevent the offense from getting rebounds, and then, like, Giannis will get every rebound. It'll be great. And so that was one thing. And then we also looked and saw that, like, hey, this is that guy's actually, when, you know, he's enormous and pretty agile for being enormous. So when guys try to shoot at him near the rim, the ball doesn't go in. So we think that we think he can be a functional defender in the scheme we want to play. So let's sign him up. Now, it turned out he was an elite defender in the system we wanted him to play. And, you know, like, hey, that's, you know, sometimes it's better lucky than good. But, like, the information was out there to tell us, to give us some confidence that he would be at least passable and an improvement over the defense we had been getting previous season from the center position.
And that's a good example, right, of the marriage between the analytics side of it and the coaching side of it, in terms of, understanding situations and putting players in the right position to be able to succeed. And it's a combination of using the numbers and using your basketball acumen to be able to figure out how to mold those two and put together the best team on the floor that takes advantage of the most situations offensively and defensively, which is ultimately what you're trying to do.
Exactly. And this is something that I think this is a lesson that I try to when I'm talking to analysts is to remember that the numbers aren't the game. Like the number, like to be able to look at all the games, look at multiple seasons of games at once, we kind of create these abstractions of what happened, but that's not actually what happened. And so always remembering that you've removed some context, you've removed some detail, and sometimes those details matter, and you need to work to understand the game well enough to know when those details matter and when they don't. When it's okay that we don't care about these instances anymore, or these things that might be different anymore, or we really care about it, so the metric we're using doesn't actually apply. Like that's just massively important for really in any sport. That's why understanding like the sport specific knowledge is just massively important to be an effective analyst, to be an effective communicator of analysis. To even if you're performing high level, like graduate school level statistics, like understanding what your inputs do and don't mean. Like he's like, oh well, this is all perfect and perfectly accurate, and every assist is the same, and right. It's like, no, we know that's not true. And so figuring out when we care and when we don't about that is pretty important.
Context is everything.
Yeah.
All right, let's wrap it up there. I want to give you a chance before we get out to share how people can reach out to you, how people can find out more about what you're doing, where they can read you on The Athletic. Just put together all the things that you have out there that people can find out more.
Sure. So the book, The Mid-Range Theory, came out last fall. It is available, I haven't seen it in any bookstores recently, but it's still available on like Amazon and places like that. Or you can order it through bookshop.org if you want to support a local bookstore, which I think you should. Also, it's available on audiobook, just came out about a month ago, and the paperback is going to come out in the fall, which reminds me, among the things I have to do is to finish writing the intro to the paperback edition of the book. No pressure there. I'm writing a couple times a month at The Athletic. It's going to be some playoff stuff, and then my annual player tiers piece, which always makes everyone happy because I never underrate their favorite players.
You don't anger any fan bases.
No, never. So that'll come out right around Summer League. Be a really interesting one this year. It's going to be a lot of movement from past years at the top, wondering what to do with James Harden, what to do with LeBron James.
I would drop James Harden. How about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's going to be lower than he has been in the past.
That sounds fair.
Like what to do with Jason Tatum and Luka Doncic in terms of where to put them amongst the elite. I'm going to get off on a rant, but I'm very like picky. I think this is a mistake a lot of teams make, is the difference between a top 15 guy and a top 5 guy in terms of how good that is for your team is massive. And so I'm very picky about like the guys who are the top, like Giannis and Kevin Durant and Jokic and maybe one or two others, and that's it. So
we gotta figure that out on the contract side, right? That's where you get into, that's where teams get in trouble, right? Is paying guy number 12 like he's guy number 1, 2, or 3. That's where you get yourself in trouble real fast as a franchise.
Although frankly, the individual max for the most part deals with that, because like unless the guy who's like the 12th best player has been in the league forever and can get the 35% max, like 30% max is
still
perfectly
doable.
Fine.
Yeah,
it's perfectly fine for a player at that level.
Still doable.
So I have with Dave Dufour and Mo DeKeel have our podcast Nerder She Wrote. Every week, Mo was a video coordinator in the NBA for a decade.
Mo's been on with us.
Okay,
yeah.
And Dave is kind of coached all over the world, so we have a lot of fun with it. I have my own podcast on the Call In app, where I a couple times a week just chopping it up with. Basically, I said, "Hey, have the same conversations you do with your friends, just record them." so going there doing you go. That.
That's good stuff.
I think that's. Oh, and you follow me on Twitter at Seth Partnow. Sometimes there's analysis. A lot of times I'm just making fun of the announcers at these playoff games.
Hey, that's good. That's fun stuff. That's what it's all about. No question about it. Did you record the audiobook yourself?
Oh, no.
You had somebody else read it?
Oh, yeah. That would have been a deal breaker. Okay. If they didn't want me to read it, there was not going to be an audiobook. No, Miren Fader, who wrote the Giannis autobiography, told me that when they had her do the audiobook, and she said, first of all, it took forever because, you know, she had to get the pronunciation right of a lot of Greek names and stuff.
For
like
sure,
that.
It's way harder than you think to read.
But the other part is as she's reading it, the urge to edit.
Right.
The urge, I really hate how I wrote that. And it's by the time you finish a book, you're so sick of those words.
Yeah, you're done.
I haven't reread the book. I don't really have any plans to reread the book. Just because I was so much time with it, maybe eventually, but it's how when you hear yourself recorded, it's I don't love the way I sound.
For sure.
Now imagine that at 80,000 words.
Yeah. No thanks. No thanks. I'll pass on that one, Seth. Pass on that.
Yeah. So that's a long-winded way of saying, no, I did not read the audiobook.
Got it. Completely understood.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Seth, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us. It's been a lot of fun. As I said earlier, I looked up and we were already at an hour and 35 minutes, which is always a sign of a great conversation. So thank you for that. Really appreciate you being a part of the Hoopheads Pod. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.